this evening, being the third and the closing part of the current series, where we've been focusing on the biblical books of the Second Temple period, the books of Shivat Zion, I want to focus on the books of, I almost said the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, whereas in reality it's really the book of Ezra, who was kind enough to share the credit with his apparently younger contemporary Nehemiah. In fact, not only did they agree between themselves apparently to share the authorship or the attribution of this biblical book, but at least according to some sources, they were even kind enough to share the same, pardon my Ashkenazic origins, seeping through the cracks, Yahrzeit. There will be, in only about a Hebrew month's time, a series of days, consecutive days, on which we are commended to fast. We all know of the Ta'anit Tzibur on Asara B'Tevet, but the truth is that Chet Tevet and Tet Tevet are also fast days. They are no longer observed, not at least in public, but they were, for a long period of time, equivalent fast days. The eighth day of Tevet, according to the consensus of the sources, marks the anniversary of the Septuagint. They say the anniversary of the translation of the Torah into Greek, something which the rabbis were not particularly thrilled with. The Talmud, again, Masechet Megillah, reports that on the day that the Torah was translated into Greek, that there were all sorts of ominous signs. Therefore, the day which ostensibly marks that translation entered into our tradition as a day of fasting. And then there is the ninth of Tevet, and the sources are very, very interesting. They say on the ninth of Tevet, the rabbis also decreed a fast day, but for no specific reason. Now, you know that nothing abhors a vacuum more than religiously inspired speculation, and therefore there are proliferation of opinions regarding the origin of the fast of the ninth of Tevet. And the one that's repeated most often and made its way down into the latest sources, into the Mishnah Brura and elsewhere, is that the ninth of Tevet is the Yom HaPetirah, the Yahrzeit of Ezra HaSofer. And then there's an additional note which says kind of like, and if you think that the Yahrzeit of Ezra is not by itself a sufficient reason to declare a fast day, so you should know that it was also the Yahrzeit of Nehemiah. So being the Yom HaPetirah, being the Yahrzeit of both Ezra and Nehemiah, so apparently it's a sufficiently mournful or sorrowful day to warrant the declaration of a fast day. But then that didn't stop the speculation. In the 11th century, Rabbi Avraham ibn Daud, that is to say, one of the several scholars of the 12th and 13th century who happened to have the same Rashi Tevot, Rabbi Avraham ben David, the most famous of whom, at least in the yeshiva world, is called the Ravid, and that is the scholar of Pasker who wrote strictures, Hasagot, on the Mishneh Torah of Rambam. There was also an Ibn Daud, Rabbi Avraham ibn Daud, who lived in Toledo in the 11th century, and wrote a very important and significant book in Hebrew called the Sefer HaKabbalah, with nothing at all to do with what Kabbalah has come to mean today. It was simply a book of Jewish history. And in it, he remarks how astute the rabbis were, that almost 1,000 years in advance of the fact they declared a Ta'anit Tzibur on the ninth day of Tevet, knowing that on the ninth day of Tevet in the year 1069, Yehosef, the son of Shmuel HaNagid, would be assassinated. But I think by far the most interesting, and I think perhaps the most correct speculation, and it's still speculation, on the subject, was advanced by a 12th century Spanish Jewish scholar, Rabbi Avraham Bar Chia, who was the author, among other things, of a book, a Sefer HaYibur, astronomical, mathematical treatise dealing primarily with the question of the fixing of the Jewish calendar. And in his work on the calendar, he made a very interesting observation. He observed that the ninth of Tevet, of the year preceding the year one of the Common Era, was the 25th of December. Now, it doesn't matter that we now know that Jesus was not born in the year preceding the year one of the Common Era. He was born 3 or perhaps even 4 years earlier, right? But what matters is that that is when he was believed to have been born. Therefore, what he implies is that the Chachamim declared a Ta'anit Tzibur on the day on which Jesus was believed to have been born, and then with great probity and prudence declined to make that public. Okay, in any event, that just brings us back to Ezra. Pardon me? Where is it recorded? In Megillat Ta'anit. Okay. So the earliest source that I know of is Megillat Ta'anit. It's reported in the Siman following the Hilchot Tish'a B'Av, where there's the record of other Ta'aniyot. Okay, that was just simply a long digression, having said Ezra and Nehemiah. What I'd like to do this evening is to go through the books of Ezra and Nehemiah with the Tanakh, pausing not everywhere, but at some significant milestones to actually read some of the text. And then primarily by means of the material that I distributed to you this evening, to look through some passages in the Talmud and in the Mishneh Torah of Rambam to see how the activities of Ezra and Nehemiah, or the activities of the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, left an impact on subsequent developments in Halakha, and in fact how they impacted upon the complexion of Yahadut, of Judaism, throughout the Second Temple period and perhaps even longer. The book of Ezra begins in the very first chapter, as we noted already last week when we compared the beginning of Ezra with the concluding portion of Divrei Hayamim. It begins with the text of the declaration of Koresh, of Cyrus, the king of Persia, who declared, Kol mamlechot ha'aretz natan li Hashem Elohe ha'shamayim, that I have been given dominion by God over all the kingdoms of the earth, v'hu fakad alai livnot lo vayit, and he has commanded me to construct a domicile for him, b'Yerushalayim asher b'Yehuda, in the city of Jerusalem in the province of Judea, mi vachem mikol amo, whosoever amongst the population of Persia who identifies with the people of this God, Yehi Elohavimo, may his God be with him, V'ya'al, and he may ascend to Yerushalayim Asher Bihuda, V'yiven et Beit Hashem Elohei Yisrael, Hu HaElohim Asher Bihushalayim. And there he will participate in the building of a domicile for this God, who is the God of Jerusalem. V'chol HaNishar Mikol HaMikomot Asher Hu Gar Sham, but whosoever identifies with this nation, with this God, and declines to take this opportunity to return to Jerusalem and to Judea, yinasu anshei mikomo b'chesef u'b'zahav u'b'rchush u'v'v'heima, that im hanedavah levet Elohim asher b'Yerushalayim, that they should make provision for those who are returning and equip them with what they will need in order to participate in this labor. The result is that a very minuscule portion of the population returns. You recall last week we actually saw the figures, and it totaled little more than 42,000. I think 42,360 or some such figure, of which in fact we were only able to account for 32,000 in the actual calculations, and we were left to fill in the gap based on the Agadah preserved in the Seder Olam Rabbah, that these consisted of people from the 10 tribes. I pointed out to you, in fact, that's one of the two myths which have adhered to the beginning of the Second Temple period. The first myth was that before the return of Jews from Mesopotamia, the land of Judea was somewhat Judenrein. That is to say that it had been entirely rid of all Jews, and yet we saw by reading the texts that at no time were all the Jews banished from Judea. And the second myth is that all of us today who are neither Kohanim nor Leviim must perforce be from either the tribe of Yehuda, or the tribe of Binyamin, because all of the other tribes have long since disappeared. And the truth is that it isn't only the evidence of the Seder Olam, which implies that there were Jews from the 10 lost tribes who participated in Shivat Zion, but the text itself, both in Ezra and in Nehemiah, where there is a very, very detailed breakdown of the principal participants in this return to Zion, makes reference on one hand to and the other people of Israel. After it enumerates Judeans and Benjaminites, it makes specific reference to the other people of Israel. And in fact, there is specific reference in Divrei Hayamim to Jews from the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. In Divrei Hayamim Aleph, Perek Tet, V'chol Yisrael hityachasu. This is the important thing that we will come to shortly in greater detail, both in the book of Ezra and in the book of Nehemiah, the necessity at the beginning of the Second Temple period for people to establish their genealogical bona fides. So many people were discovered upon the return to Yerushalayim to have been the products of intermarriages, that it was necessary before the Beit HaMikdash was rebuilt, and particularly for Kohanim and Leviim, before they resumed their responsibilities in the Beit HaMikdash, to establish that they were, in fact, genuine Kohanim and Leviim. Less of a concern for Yisraelim in that respect, but certainly as much of a concern in terms of the application of the halacha. Therefore, it says, V'inam ktuvim asefer malchei Yisrael v'Yehuda hoglu levavel b'ma'alam, that this is subsequent to the exile of the Judeans to Babylonia on account of their iniquities. And vayoshvim arishonim asher b'chuzatam ba'areihem, right, with respect to the returnees to Zion, Yisrael hakohanim aleviim v'hanetinim uv'Yerushalayim yashivu min b'nei Yehuda u min b'nei Binyamin, and look at that, u min b'nei Ephraim u min Asher. Now, having said it and having brought the text to your attention, I should add quickly that the text does in fact, not the text, but the situation avails itself of other interpretations. These descendants of Ephraim and Menasheh need not necessarily have been people of Ephraim and Menasheh who were exiled by the Assyrians almost 200 years before the return to Zion, and who somehow had found their way back to Judea, not only from Babel, from Mesopotamia, but had found their way back from Halach and Chavor, wherever they happened to be, and Gozan, wherever that is in Asia Minor. There is, however, another possibility. The other possibility is that these were genuine Ephraimites and Manassites, so to speak, but that these were descendants of the tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh, who had taken up residence in the land of Judea prior to the exile of the Aseret HaShevatim. There are references in Divrei Hayamim that when King Chizkiyahu, who was the king of Yehuda at the time that the 10 tribes were exiled, caused to be celebrated in Jerusalem a Pesach, right? A great celebration of Pesach, he extended an invitation called Dichvin. He extended an invitation to the Pesach celebration to the northern tribes as well. So it's possible that there were people from Ephraim and Menasheh, and maybe from others of those 10 tribes, who accepted that invitation and remained in Yerushalayim not only for the celebration of Pesach, but in fact transferred their residences there, and therefore they were exiled to Babylonia by Nebuchadnezzar along with the genuine Judeans. And therefore, just as there were genuine Judeans who returned, so there were people of Ephraim and Manasseh who returned, but this is not yet the return of the 10 lost tribes. Okay. The Perek continues, and it describes the response to the proclamation of Koresh. And the response is that a group of people, led, as we see in Pasuk Chet, by Shesh Batzar HaNasi Lihuda, Shesh Batzar, who was a member of the royal family, a scion of the house of David, but of course, living in Babylonia, did not call himself king, but was known as the Nasi, or the prince, led a number of people from Babel to Yerushalayim. And in chapters 2 and 3, we have an account of how the Zerubbabel and the people who kept his company built a Mizbeach. The Gemara refers to this subsequently, Shamarati Shemakrivim. The Gemara says that we know we have a tradition that it is permissible to offer sacrifices even in the absence of the temple. So we have the record of their return, a very detailed list of all of the people in terms of their places of residence. Then a description in Perek Gimel, as I said, of how they began the construction of the city, how they built a Mizbeach, and how they began the construction of the city and of the Beit HaMikdash. But we come to a screeching halt at the beginning of Perek Dalet, when Tzarei Yehuda uVinyamin, when the antagonists of the Judeans and the Benjaminites discover that they are building a temple in Jerusalem, and they make an overture to Zerubbabel and to Yehoshua, who have become the leaders of the people, an overture to participate in the building of the temple. And the response they receive in Pasuk Gimel is, Lo lachem valanu livnot bayit le'eloheinu. This is not a, what do the Japanese call it? The Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, something like that. This is not a project to be undertaken by everybody. Anachnu yachad nivne l'Hashem Elohei Yisrael kasher tzivanu ha-melech Koresh melech Paras. Right? This is our responsibility. And the result is, as we see in Pasuk Vav, Uve malachut achash ve'rosh, bitchilat malachuto, katvu sitna al yoshevei Yehuda v'Yerushalayim. That the rejection of their offer to participate, of course planted the seeds of enmity, and as a result, there is an interruption in the process of the construction of the city and of the temple. And it does not achieve its completion until, as we see in the very, very last verse in chapter 4, actually the next to the last verse in Pasuk Kaf Gimel, right? Uvatilu himo. There is an instruction to cease. The king orders a cessation of the building. Bedayin, whereupon bitelat avidat beit el ahadi birushalem. There was a halt in the construction of the temple in Jerusalem. Vahavat batla, and it remained in cessation. Ad shnat tartein lemalchut daryavesh melech paras. That there was a hiatus, and the building did not resume until the second year of the reign of the Persian king Darius. Now, in chapter 5 and in chapter 6, we have reference to the participation at this point in time of the Navi Haggai, of the Navi Zechariah, and not to get too bogged down in the Aramaic text, if we take a hop, skip, and jump towards the end of chapter 6, with Pasuk Yod Tet, where we resume the Hebrew text. Vayasuv ne'agolayeta pasach bi'arba'ar asar l'chodesh harishom ki hittaharu ha-kohanim v'ha-leviyim ke'ehad kulam tehorim. That because all of the Kohanim and Leviyim had managed to purify themselves, they were able to offer the Korban Pesach l'chol b'nei ha-gola u'la'acheihem ha-kohanim v'lahem, for all of those who had returned from the diaspora, as well as for their fellow Levites and priests. Vayochlu v'nei Yisrael ha-shavim mi'agola v'chol ha-nivdal mitumat goyei ha-aretz aleihem, and all of the Jews who had returned from the diaspora and were similarly ritually pure, because that is a precondition for the Korban Pesach, were able to participate, lidrosh l'Hashem Elohei Yisrael, and to celebrate the festival. ויעשו חג מצות שבעת ימים בשמחה, כי שמחם השם ויסב לב מלך אשור עליהם לחזק ידיהם במלאכת בית האלוהים אלוהי ישראל. Because now finally the king, who is referred to as the king of Assyria, but he's not so much the king of Assyria in the political sense as he is the king of Mesopotamia in the geographical sense, had relented and now was about to issue the permission for the concluding portion of the work. And here at the beginning of Perek Zayim is where we have our introduction personally to Ezra. Achar advarim ha'ela, that is to say, after the original Shivat Zion with Shesh Batzar, with Zerubbabel, with Yehoshua, after the interruption of the work, and now hard upon the resumption of the work, B'malchut ha'tachshasta melech paras, not Koresh, not Daryavesh, but Artachshasta, right? The Artachshasta during whose reign the work, the part of whose reign the work was still interrupted. Ezra ben Sraya ben Azariah ben Chilkiah ben etc. into Pasuk Vav. Who Ezra? This Ezra, who was a descendant of Aharon HaKohen HaRosh, Alami Bavel. He came from Mesopotamia to join with those people who had already returned to Zion. V'hu sofer mahir b'torat Moshe. He is described as a... what kind of a scribe? What's mahir? Does it mean quick simply in the sense that he was able to take dictation quickly? Come, what's mahir mean? Mahir means skilled or clever, right? So he was not, in fact, if he was quick, then the speed was the consequence of his skill. Do you have to have a great intellect in order to be a skilled calligrapher? No. But the implication here is that Ezra was not merely a skilled calligrapher, but that he was a sofer mahir b'torat Moshe asher natan Hashem Elohei Yisrael, that he was knowledgeable in the Torah, not merely capable of transcribing it, but in fact capable of interpreting it and of elucidating it. As a matter of fact, one of the sources that I prepared for you this evening, the one which appears on the page of the Talmud from Masechet Sanhedrin, right on the very top of the page, it says Perek Sheni Sanhedrin. If you go down to the little arrow in the margin, which is about four or five lines from the bottom of that page, it says Tanya Rabbi Yose Omer Ra'uy haya Ezra shetinaten Torah al yadoli Yisrael, that Ezra was worthy of being the instrument of the revelation of the Torah to the Jewish people, ilmalei lo kedamo Moshe, were it not simply for the accident of history that he was preceded by Moshe. And indeed, this phrase captures a good deal of the importance which Jewish tradition of the Second Temple period and then of the Mishnah and Talmud attribute to Ezra. Not merely that his stature was so great that he was worthy of being an instrument of the revelation of the Torah, but as a matter of fact, he basically becomes the instrument of the revelation of the Torah. On the basis of the argument that a good deal of the Torah which had been revealed to Moshe was lost or forgotten as a result of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash and as a result of the Babylonian exile, it was necessary for Ezra at the beginning of the Second Temple period, as it were, to recover the lost Torah. And indeed, a phrase recurs in several passages in the Talmud and Midrash, saying, in effect, Shechachom v'chazeru v'yisidum, that there were in fact numerous aspects of halacha which were forgotten during the time, or as a result of the catastrophe of the Churban and the ensuing exile, and it was the responsibility of Ezra and the responsibility of the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, whose identity we'll get into in a short while, to restore the knowledge which had been lost. So that in effect, if Ezra was confronting a people who in many respects were not knowledgeable in the Torah, then it wasn't just that Ezra, if he had only lived 1,000 years earlier, he could have been the person who went up on Mount Sinai and brought the Torah down to the Jewish people. But in effect, Ezra does bring the Torah to the Jewish people. As a matter of fact, the continuation of the passage here in Sanhedrin, if you look at the very last line on that page, Va'afal pi shelo nitna Torah al yado, that even though, again, just because of an historical accident, he was not able to serve as the original instrument of the revelation of the Torah, in any event, nishtana al yado hakitav, he was instrumental in the writing of the Torah. There's a passage again in the Talmud in Masechet Megillah which speculates on in what alphabet was the Torah originally written. Was it written in the squared alphabet called Ketav Ashuri, which is basically the same alphabet that we print Hebrew in today, or in which Sifrei Torah continue to be written? Or was the Torah originally written in the so-called Paleo-Hebrew script, the one which Hebrew shares with Phoenician and with other Semitic languages, and which the Talmud calls Ketav Ivri? Now, it's very interesting. What we have here is a very, very political difference of opinion with the Talmud Bavli, not surprisingly, ruling that the original Hebrew alphabet was the Ktav Ashuri, where the parallel passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi rules that the original alphabet was the Ktav Ivri. The proof, which is adduced by the Talmud Bavli in support of its contention that the original alphabet was the one that we recognize, is Mem V'Samach Shebeluchot B'Neis Hayu Omidim, that the letters Mem and Samach, which in the squared Hebrew alphabet are completely enclosed, stood in the Luchot miraculously, because since the Luchot were engraved through and through, all letters like Mem and Samach, which are completely enclosed, should have just fallen out. What's the proof brought by the Talmud Yerushalmi to support its contention? It is a different version of this legend. Its version is Ayin Shebeluchot B'neis Haya Omed, that the letter Ayin, which in the Paleo-Hebrew script lives up to its name, it's actually a replication of an I and is a rounded letter, right? Being again a completely enclosed letter, according to their version of the tradition, it was the Ayin which stood miraculously. So any event, based at least on the fact that this passage is in the Talmud Bavli, the fact that Ezra, when he taught the Jewish people the Torah again at the beginning of the Second Temple period, taught it to them, or as it were, revealed it to them in this not new, but renewed alphabet, then that is effectively the equivalent of having given them the Torah. Okay. So Ezra, who is described as this Sofer Mahir B'Torat Moshe, it says, Vayiten lo hamelech ki yad Hashem Elohav alav kol bakashato, that he was given provision by the king, by Artachshasta. Whatever he requested was given to him. Maybe in the way of provisions, it may be in the way of authority. And we get once again in the continuation here an Aramaic text which again describes the provisions which he and the people who accompanied him brought with them. And again, if we just skip down to the two concluding verses in the chapter, which resume again in Hebrew, Baruch Hashem Elohe Avotenu Asher Natan Kazot B'Lev HaMelech Lefa'er Beit Hashem Asher Birushalayim. It was in fact the desire of the Persian king to make a contribution towards the glorification of the temple in Jerusalem. Va'alai, says Ezra in the first person, Va'alai hita chesed lefnei hamelech, that God presented me favorably before the king, and therefore v'ani et chazakti ki yad Hashem Elohai alai, I therefore girded my loins, va'ekbitzami Yisrael rashim la'aloti mi, and I sought amongst the Jews who had remained in Mesopotamia, rashim, that is to say, important people, to join me now in reinforcing the Jewish settlement in Judea and Jerusalem. Yes, sir, there was a question in the back. At least according to another tradition, he didn't have that problem, since there were no surviving copies. Well, there were no surviving authoritative copies. There's a tradition which seeks to account for that particular Masoretic scribal phenomenon called Kreyu Chativ. And it accounts for it in the following fashion. It says that when Ezra returned from Bavel and set about the task of reconstituting the Torah, he could not find an authorized copy of the Torah. What's an authorized copy of the Torah? It means either the original Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu, presuming, of course, that it lasted intact throughout the entire First Temple period, or, even if that Torah did not last intact throughout the First Temple period, whatever copies would have been made from that original. But apparently no copies which were known to have been made from that original had survived the Chorban. Therefore, this source continues and says that Ezra collected all of the texts which were available, and in reconstituting the text of the Torah, obviously, where all of the texts were in agreement, that's what he wrote. Where the texts were in disagreement amongst each other, then he followed the halachic principle of rov, of majority, and the Torah that he produced, and which then became the new standard Torah, followed whatever was the majority of the remaining copies of the Torah. On occasion, however, there was either not a clear majority, or even if there was a numerical majority, it was difficult to tell which of the versions should be preserved because they were so radically different from each other. It was for this purpose, reports this source, that Ezra invented this Masoretic scribal phenomenon called Korei Uchetiv in order to preserve both of the extant versions. The Torah that Ezra produced then ostensibly was deposited in the Beit HaMikdash, so that we know that during the Second Temple period, when people wanted to write a text of the Torah, they would come to Yerushalayim, right, and they would there copy that text. That text comes to be known in Mishnaic literature, depending upon the version you read. In some cases it's referred to Sefer HaAzara, right, as though this were a book which was kept deposited in the temple. But in other versions, Azara is written with an Aleph at the end instead of a Hey, and it becomes Sefer Ezra, as though this were in fact the copy that was prepared by Ezra himself. And the Mishnah tells us, Magihei HaSefarim BiYerushalayim. The Mishnah tells us that in Yerushalayim there was in fact a caste, a guild of Sofarim, who in fact were salaried. Their salary was paid by the treasury of the Beit HaMikdash. And it was their responsibility that whenever somebody came to them with a Sefer Torah and said, is this correct? They would then take it and they would compare it with the prototypical Sefer that was written by Ezra. Okay. This is what we have throughout... No. The At the moment, the earliest source I can cite you for it is Radak. Radak was very, very interested in scribal phenomena. I even wrote a book on it, Eitz Sofer, I think. In a couple of places in his commentary on Tanakh, he relates this. I don't remember. I think it's in his commentary on Yeshayahu. I don't remember exactly now precisely where in Radak it is located, but what I just related now is in fact from the commentary of Radak. He does not specifically cite or attribute it. It's not a question of pulling it off. According to, at least to the tradition of the Talmud Bavli, Ezra was restoring the Torah to the alphabet in which it had originally been written. Therefore, even if during the First Temple period the Hebrew script which was used for ordinary purposes was the Paleo-Hebrew script, the presumption, or at least the implicit presumption, is that Sifrei Torah continued to be written in the Ktav Ashurei. The problem is, according to the version of the Talmud Yerushalmi, which assumes that even Sifrei Torah during the First Temple period were written in the Ktav Ivri, in which case what Ezra did was revolutionary, but he had the authority for it. Other things changed at this point in time. The Talmud tells us, Shmot Hechodashim Alui Mahem Mibavel. Apparently the period of time that people had spent in Babylonian captivity was long enough, or perhaps the trauma of the Churban and the Galut were themselves sufficient, that it simply prepared people for these drastic or radical changes. Whereas under more normal circumstances, people would have been aghast at these kinds of radical changes and would have branded them and condemned them as innovations. What they were prepared to do under these circumstances was swallow them and explain that they were not innovations, but renovations. I don't know whether the passage is there. He does, in his introduction to Yoshua, refer to such... Kol HaKavod. Kol HaKavod. Kol HaKavod. It may very well be there, but it's definitely, as I say, I cited on the authority of Radak. I do not recall that Radak himself provides an attribution for it. If they say Chachamim Hizaharu B'Divreichem, then people come on the Alachat Kama V'Chama if after such a long time you still remember. That's one opinion.
There's an opinion.
Yes. Well, as I said, but the emphasis on the luchot and the manipulation of the alphabet from mem and samach on one hand to ayin on the other. Yes.
And they even had the choice to take the lashon arami if they wanted to take it. Islam and so on. The Bavli also holds that he had the option, or Bnei Israel had the option, to change their language if they wanted from.
No, I don't think there were gematriot in those days. It's really get us a little bit off the topic, but there is at least archaeological evidence today that the Hebrew alphabet, as we know it, might at one time have had a different sequence. It's a very, very slight alteration, but the sequence of Pei and Ayin is different, in fact, in some of our biblical texts, as it is different in two of the Prakim of Eicha. There is archaeological evidence in the form of things called ABCderies. That's just simply copies of the alphabet in which systematically and regularly the sequence of ayin and pei is inverted so that pei precedes ayin. So if that in fact would knock all of these gematriot to in a loop, and in fact would put an end to all of the business that some people have been making out of the Torah with computers over the last 10 years, I for one would not regret it. I walked into to my synagogue 2 weeks ago and was aghast to find people walking around marveling at how Rabin's assassination had been foretold in the parasha, ostensibly in the pasuk of Vinei Tanur Ashan V'Lapid Eish Ashar Avar Bein HaGizarim Ha'Ela. And somebody even told me that if you read the letters differently, it says Eish, Eish, Rabin, as though somehow the Torah was actually saying that Rabin deserved to be assassinated. And I was aghast at it, and I pulled out my chumash, and I said, I have another reference to Rabin's assassination in the Torah, in which you don't have to move around a single letter or a single vowel. And everybody ran over quickly to see what it was, and I hold up the Aseret HaDibrot, and I showed them Lo Tirtzach. So, I for one am not going to worry about that. Okay, let's return. Go ahead.
I heard before this, but I want to give you an opportunity to agree, is that at the same time the Shomronim were using the Hebrew, the original Torah, the original alphabet, and therefore there were people who were confused by the Shomronim's Torah, which was different from the traditional one, and then it was different.
Well, that in fact is the passage in the Gemara, when the Gemara says that the Jewish people chose for themselves Ktav Ashuri, and it says V'hinichu Ktav Ivri le'ameh ha'aretz. I don't remember the precise wording, but it says that Hedyotot, thank you, Hedyotot. And all the commentaries on Hedyotot, in fact, say that these are the Shomronim. So indeed, that's certainly consistent with the passage. Okay. So that in Perek Zion and in Perek Chet, we have the report about Ezra's journey from Mesopotamia to Jerusalem, and of his arrival in Jerusalem, and of the permit which King Artaxasta gave him to resume and to eventually complete the building of the city and of the Beit HaMikdash. And then in Perek Tet, and in Perek Yod, we get a description of some of Ezra's activities, particularly the activities I alluded to previously in terms of the purification of the lineage. If you will join me in Pasuk Yod of Perek Tet, we can just read a couple of psukim and get the essence of this activity. Va'ata, man nomar Eloheinu acharezot ki azavnu mitzvotecha. Right, God, we can't look you in the face. I mean, so to speak, after we have abandoned your mitzvot, asher tzivita b'yam avadecha hanevi'im lemor. Particularly, you commanded us, Ha'aretz asher atem ba'im lirishta. And this is harked back to the many times that the Torah warns about the consequences of the conquest of the land of Canaan. Eretz niddahi b'niddat amei ha'aretzot. That it is a land which has certain very negative associations with certain abominations. B'to'avotehem asher milu'uha mipe el pe betuma atam. V'ata b'notechem אל תיתנו לבניהם, ובנותיהם, אל תישאו לבניכם. This is the Torah's warning, not to intermarry with the Canaanites. ולא תדרשו שלומם וטובתם עד עולם. Have nothing to do with them. למען תחזקו. So that you will be able to reinforce yourselves, rather than to have your strength diluted. ואכלתם את טוב הארץ וורשתם לבניכם עד עולם. And if indeed you follow these instructions, then the land will be yours and your descendants in perpetuity. And as a consequence of all of our iniquities, uvashmatenu agidola, ki ata Eloheinu chasachta lemata me'avoneinu v'natata lanu pleita kazot. And after you've been so good to us, in spite of all that we have done to you, hanashuv lahafer mitzvotecha, should we now resume our previous iniquities, ulehitchaten ba'amei ha'toivot ha'ela, and once again resume wholesale intermarriage with these abomination-practicing peoples, halot enaf banu ad kale. Were we to do so, you would be justified in being exceedingly vexed with us. Le'ein she'eret ufleta. This time around, however, you would not be as kind or as compassionate as you were the first time, and we would not have a surviving remnant. Therefore, the people come and they tell in Perek Yod with Pasuk, beginning with Pasuk Gimel, they consent. They consent to what they call a Brit, a new covenant. And the object of this covenant is Lehotzi Chol Nashim Vanolad Mehem Ba'atzat Adonai V'Charedim B'Mitzvat Eloheinu V'Chatorah Ye'aseh. To those who were married to such women would divorce them, and those who had children from such marriages would disown them. So that this was the first of the principal accomplishments. So that when the city of Jerusalem was completed, when the Beit HaMikdash was built, that the city and the Mikdash should be served and should be populated by people who were at least genealogically pure. And here we end with the part of the book which is named for Ezra, and we commence with the part of the book which is named for Nehemiah. And in the first perek and the beginning of the second perek, we are introduced to Nehemiah, who, after Ezra, as you recall, puts himself in the seventh year of Artaxasta. Nehemiah places himself in the 20th year of Artaxasta, 13 years later. Nehemiah tells us that he was in Shushan HaBira, and somebody arrived, someone from Jerusalem arrived, and told him the sad and woe-begone story of how the city is still a disgrace, and the walls of the city are breached, and the gates of the city have been burned to the ground. And he is so moved by this tale that he approaches the king and is effectively given by the king the authority to go to Jerusalem and to enforce the completion of the building of the city, which apparently was still being held in abeyance on account of the interruption and the intercession of these same Tzarei Yehuda v'Vinyamin to whom we referred previously. So that Perek Bet, beginning with Pasuk Tet, Nehemiah arrives and he presents to everybody his letters of introduction from the king, and he even comes in the company of Persian officers and horsemen. But when Sanballat the Horoni, Tovia the Ammoni, hear about this, right? These are the Tzarei Yehuda v'Vinyamin. They try once again to foil the building plans, so that Nehemiah now, throughout the remainder of Perek Bet and Perek Gimel, has to set about the task of rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem while he's being harassed. And as a result, he hits upon the stratagem of people, in fact, working in shifts and keeping their weapons near at hand and positioning people with trumpets on the walls, so that any time there was any kind of an attempt to interrupt the building, the alarm would be sounded, and the people who were working would have their weapons near at hand, and would be able to take up their weapons and rush to the defense of the city. And it is only in such a way that he manages to successfully complete the building. Yes. No. Before the completion of the walls, we date the completion of the Beit HaMikdash as being during the time of Daryavesh, earlier on. But although the physical building of the Beit HaMikdash was standing and the Avodah was going on, the city of Yerushalayim around it and the walls of the city were still in ruins. The building of the temple itself was begun under the time of Koresh and was interrupted most promptly, and was resumed only in the sixth year of Daryavesh, and was completed shortly thereafter. To use our secular chronology for it, it began with the Shivat Zion in 536, and was completed in 516. But although the building of the temple per se was completed, the completion of the city and of the walls remained down till the time of Ezra, which is in 458, and even remains further to the time of Nehemiah, who does not arrive until 445. Oh, it's the same king. If you look at the list of the Persian kings, Artaxerxes reigns from 465 to 422. He has a quite a long reign. He has approximately a 45-year reign. No, we went through that the first week in terms of the problem of the chronology of the... I don't know if you were here. We went through the problem of the comparison between the rabbinic chronology and the secular chronology. I don't know of any Artaxerxes other than the one who in Persian chronology, there's Cyrus, there's Cambyses, there's Darius. I don't know to what you're referring, but I'll be glad afterwards to go over to you. I'll give you, if you don't have a copy of the chronological sheet that we've been following. Rejected? Oh, who interrupted? No, these were non-Jews. Oh, no, that's something else. I said that amongst the people who returned from Galut Bavel to Yerushalayim, there clearly are people from Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay. That's rejected from... No, those were non-Jews. The people who wanted to become involved in the building and were rejected and therefore became the antagonists, these were non-Jews. These were either Samaritans, the Shomronim, or these were, as we just read now, Horonim or Ammonim. Yes. Two different kinds of problems. Practical problems in terms of harassing the builders, as well as political problems in terms of lobbying with the king to have him withdraw his permission. They constantly accuse, first Ezra and then of Nehemiah, of actually hatching a plot to rebel. They see the completion of the walls of Yerushalayim as being the prelude, or at least they are interpreting the rebuilding and refortification of Yerushalayim as the prelude to the secession of Judea from the Persian Empire. Therefore, they are lobbying with the king to have the permission revoked in order to prevent this rebellion.
But the building of the temple itself was never interrupted.
It was interrupted. It was interrupted between 536 and 516. It was interrupted then by the Shomronim. No, originally by the Shomronim. It's very difficult to explain. The Shomronim believed themselves to be Jews. All right? And yet their overture was rejected by the rabbis who did not regard them as Jewish. Therefore, they considered themselves to be as worthy as the Judeans of participating in the building, and yet they were spurned. And hell knows no fury like a Samaritan spurned. As I say, because they had a powerful lobby back in Mesopotamia, and were able to convince the king that in fact this was not a noble-minded venture that had only a spiritual purpose, but that in fact it was a disguise for a political purpose. At both junctures, the same argument was advanced. Who are we? Yes. Yes, when the Chachamim talk about Kutiyim, and they ask the question, Kutiyim Geirei Tzedek or Kutiyim Geirei Arayot, by Kutiyim they mean Samaritans, because when Sefer Melachim tells us how the king of Assyria, following the policy of the transfer of populations, exiled the 10 tribes to Asia Minor, and then took Asia Minorans and transplanted them in Samaria, it says that he brought them from Kuta. Therefore, since they originated in a place called Kuta, they were called Kutiyim. But because they were transplanted in a place called Samaria, they came to be known as Samarians, or as the King James Version has it, Samaritans. Therefore, the famous Good Samaritan of the New Testament was in fact a Shomroni. Okay, I must keep an eye on the clock, and we've got so much to do and so little time. Excuse me then if I don't take you chapter by chapter through the book of Nehemiah. It's there for you to look at. I would prefer rather to look at some of these other sources, and as I said, to try to come to some estimation of the impact which Ezra, Nehemiah, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah had, not only on the history of Halakha, but more significantly their impact on the complexion of Judaism during the time of the Second Temple. I'll go through the sources again. The first one, the first page, the top page is just like a conspectus of the sources. It just gives you little blurbs from many of the same sources that I provide inside in greater detail. The first page, the one from Masechet Yoma. Again, if you look at the arrow on the right-hand margin, about two-thirds of the way down the page. Damar Rabbi Yoshua ben Levi, Lama nikra sheman anshei Knesset HaGidola. What was so great about them? Shechaziru atara liyoshna. Again, this notion of reconstituting everything, of filling in all the gaps which had arisen as a result of the trauma of the Churban and Galut Bavel. I pause very briefly. Anshei Knesset HaGidola. How many people were there? We all know traditionally that there were 120 of them. 70 is the Sanhedrin, but that there were 120. It is an open question as to whether it means that this was a body which continued throughout several successive generations, and in each generation it had 120 members, or whether this is a body which, either on account of the fact that it existed only in one generation, or even if it consisted throughout several generations, had a total membership start to finish of 120 people, but not necessarily 120 at any given time. This is part of the problem we alluded to in the first evening when we spoke about the fact that rabbinic chronology compresses the Persian period from 200 years to 40 years. So that, in fact, if the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah was the governing body of the Jewish people during the Persian period, so it either lasted 40 years, one generation, or it lasted 200 years. In any event, the perception of Chazal appears to be that this was a group of people that met once during one generation, and that amongst its members were Ezra himself, Nehemiah himself, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, right? Mordechai, right? And whose last member, or whose longest living or surviving member, was the Shimon HaTzadik of the first perek in Masechet Avot, Shaya Mishiare Knesset HaGidola. The second source, from Masechet Bava Kama, lists the Asara Takanot Tiken Ezra. I'm sorry, we only had an opportunity to look quickly, briefly, at the takana which pertains to the lineage, but there were takanot which pertain to the problem of Jewish slavery. People were impressing their debtors into service and were not subsequently either releasing them or relinquishing the debts. Therefore, there was a takana which addressed that problem. There were also takanot, significant takanot, that addressed the nature of prayer or the frequency of prayer. We all know that Moshe Rabbeinu already instituted Torah reading on Shabbatot, and according at least to one interpretation, he even instituted Torah readings on Mondays and Thursdays, having learned from the dreadful experience of Vayavo Amalek. It says that the Amalekites attacked the Jewish people because they had gone for 3 days without water, and since everybody knows Ein Mayim Ela Torah, they had gone for 3 days without Torah. Therefore, the institution of Torah readings on Mondays and Thursdays, as well as on Saturdays, so that there are never 3 consecutive days without Torah reading. However, even if Moshe himself did introduce Torah readings on Monday and Thursday, he introduced a Torah reading in which you simply read a minimal number of psukim from the Torah, and then Ezra's role was to elaborate on that and to provide that there should be sufficient Torah readings on Monday and Thursday to satisfy 3 Torah readers. The alternative is that Moshe instituted Torah readings only on Shabbat, and it was Ezra who instituted Torah readings on Mondays and on Thursdays, as well as instituting certain aspects of Tfilah, which I will refer to later when we get to the passage from Rambam. The third text from Sanhedrin we read, The fourth text from Berachot tells us that Anshei Knesset HaGidola Tiknu Lahem LeYisrael Berachot UTefilot Kedushot VaHavdalot. The formalization or standardization of prayer or of liturgy. The following page, Hilchot Tfilah, from the Mishneh Torah, Perak Aleph Halacha Dalet, tells us that on account, again, historical reasons, on account of the Churban, on account of the Galut, the order of prayer was interrupted, and the intelligibility of prayer was diminished, and therefore, on the next page, the top of the page, Kevan Shera'a Ezra Uveit Dinokach, once this was seen by Ezra, you don't have another page, or you do? Pardon? You don't have the continuation? Yeah, you do. Okay, I'm sorry. Kevan Shera'a Ezra Uveit Dinokach, when Ezra and his colleagues, his confreres, saw the deterioration in the practices of tefillah, Amidu v'tiknu lahem 18 brachot al haseder. They instituted standard tefillah. In fact, in halachic terms, when you talk about 18, you talk about tefillah par excellence. Do you have any other pages? That's the final page that I copied. Okay. The one that I left out, the source that I left out, is the one with which I will conclude as an illustration of the impact which they had on the complexion of the practice of Judaism during the Second Temple period. I cite to you, though it's not the only source, from Rambam again in the Mishneh Torah, Hilchot Shabbat, Perek Kaf Dalet, Halacha Yod Bet. Asru Chachamim Letaltel Miktzat Devarim B'Shabbat Kederech Shehu Oseh Bachol. The Chachamim, and who are these Chachamim? If we look in the Hasaga of the Ra'abad, he specifically relates this to Nehemiah, who in Perek Yod Gimel, the concluding Perek of the book which bears his name, tells us of how aghast he was at seeing blatant public Chilul Shabbat in Yerushalayim, and how he put an end to it through a Takana. Therefore Rambam is alluding to that Takana of Nehemiah, in which it was forbidden to carry things on Shabbat in the same manner in which they are carried during the week. The reason being, as he continues and he says, Kidein shelo yihye kiyom chol beinav, so that people should not take Shabbat for granted and should not treat it as an ordinary day. Shabbat then was one of the focuses of the Takanot of Ezra Nehemiah the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah. And in the space of a relatively short amount of time, the people of Israel went from the extreme of public Chilul Shabbat to the opposite extreme, the extreme in which they were so meticulous in the observance of Shabbat that in the book of Maccabees, Sefer HaMaccabim, Kislev, Hanukkah can't be far behind, we read the following. The Greeks arose suddenly to fall upon them on Shabbat, saying to them, how long will you refuse to obey the king? And the men in their midst, the Jews, did not raise their hands to hurl a stone or to silence them. And the Greeks fell upon them on Shabbat and killed all those in the cave, about 1,000 people. We learn from this, as well as from other sources in the books of the Maccabees, as well as parallel passages in the works of Josephus, that the Jews during the Hellenistic period would not fight even a defensive battle on Shabbat. This was changed. This was changed by Matityahu, who pointed out that there was really no point in observing Shabbat to the point that Jews would become extinct. And therefore, he originally enacted the permissibility of waging a defensive war on Shabbat. And then we learn that throughout the balance of the Second Temple period, Jews would wage defensive wars on Shabbat. First of all, they would not respond until they were actually attacked. And even then, they would only fight to defend themselves. It isn't until later on in the second, towards the close of the Second Temple period, when we're already in the Roman era, that we actually find that permission is given on Shabbat not only to fight defensive battles, but even where it was permissible to fight even aggressively or offensively. But just think of this as an illustration of the tremendous impact that the Takanot of Ezran, the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, had, how they were able to change the complexion of the people so thoroughly, so much so that, as you know, and with this I'll conclude, when the Chachamim in the Talmud cast about for a reason to explain why the Second Temple was destroyed, what do they blame it on? On Sinat Chinam. Why do they blame it on Sinat Chinam? Why didn't they blame it on the same cause which they cite for the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, which was Giloy Arayot Shvichut Damim Avodah Zarah, that is to say, the violation of basic Torah laws? Apparently, because the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah was successful enough in so altering the complexion of Jewry, at least in the land of Israel, that you could not say of the Jews, even on the eve of the destruction of the Second Temple, you could not say of them that they were in violation of essential Torah law. Doesn't mean that they were the most righteous of people. They had their faults, but at least those were not amongst them. And with this, I'm just afraid that time has brought us to an abrupt end, and I thank you very much for your participation throughout these last few weeks, and we'll meet again, I'm sure.
I'd like to thank Professor Sokolow for his inspiring lectures these past years. We're looking forward to the next knitting series that we'll have with him.